Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Tonight, 6:20 p.m. Pacific, 9:20 p.m. Eastern, CBS, the national title game, Virginia and Texas Tech. And let me start by repeating the last part of that. Texas Tech is in the national championship game. In basketball, the Red Raiders are going to the national title game in basketball. I mean, hell, if they were to do that in football, that'd be incredible. The fact that it's happening in basketball is unreal. And no, Virginia Texas Tech may not be the Duke UNC rematch that everybody was hoping for. And yes, these two may end up ugling it up a little bit. I mean, know that going in, but also know this. These are two damn good basketball teams. Two really good teams. And it's a matchup that was impossible to imagine only a few months back. And now it's only a few hours away. And it's incredible. Absolutely incredible to me. Virginia, the team that made the worst kind of history last year, could make the very best kind of history tonight. Texas Tech, a school without much basketball history at all, has practically made history every single time they have stepped on the floor this year, and they've got a chance to do it once again. Look at the coaches. Tony Bennett handled the worst loss in the best possible way ever. They came into this year with the mantra of run to the roar. In other words, do not ignore what happened against UMBC. Go ahead and embrace it. And now he's got his team playing for the national championship. Class act, obviously. Great coach. And then you've got my man, Chris Beard. All Chris Beard does is win. He shows up and he wins. Freaking every place he has ever been on every level. In places where it's not easy to win. Much less win big. Little Rock, Texas Tech. Give this guy grease board and a chance to recruit, and he will give you a team that wins. Again, Texas Tech is in the national championship game in basketball. I mean, it's absurd. It's a joke. And they didn't fluke their way there either. Nothing fluky about this. Nothing cheap, nothing lucky. Look at the last four coaches that Beard beat. Tom Izzo, Mark Few, John Beilein, Nate Oates. One Hall of Famer, two future Hall of Famers, and the guy who just got hired at Alabama. Let's talk about the weekend. Those games on Saturday night, were they any good? I can answer that for you. They sure as hell were. Why don't we start with the second game and work backwards? Because the second game was vintage Chris Beard, Texas Tech. Red Raiders absolutely took it to Michigan State. Tom Izzo said, quote, "We prided ourselves on being the toughest team. Tonight, we weren't," end quote. But then again, that's what Chris Beard's team will do. They lock you up, even when you know it's coming. Even when you expect it, they're still going to make it 40 minutes of living hell. But don't get too focused on that defense. See, to me, this is where this is all getting lost in translation. It's a great defensive team. And I don't mean great this year, because they are the best team in America defensively. I mean great historically. But when you get so caught up in that defense, you don't give them credit for their offense. They can score the ball now. And they did exactly that when they had to. Late in the game against Michigan State, and then they put them away. Tech made it look like they had been there before, even though they had never been there before. And they made it look a hell of a lot easier than it actually was. And speaking of easy, there was nothing easy about Auburn, Virginia. In fact, that was insane. Auburn, Virginia was insane. Now, let me get three things out of the way really quickly. Going back to Saturday, number one, yes, it was a foul. Yes, it was a foul. Yes, it was a double-double and double dribble, I should say. And yes, it really, really sucks for Auburn. Let me run those three things by you again really quickly. Yes, it was a foul. Yes, it was a double dribble. And yes, that really, really sucks for Auburn. But before we get to the final seconds, go back a little bit earlier. Go back to Kyle Guy getting the ball with 9 seconds left, down four, and then doing this.
10 seconds to go into the corner. Guy launching a three. Got it! A three in the right corner. Good with 6.5 seconds to go. It's a one-point game and a foul before the inbound.
That's Westwood one. And for all the attention on guys' free throws and that double dribble, do not sleep on that three because that was absurd. Miss that, the game is over. But it wasn't. Get used to hearing that phrase because you're about to hear it a lot. Guy drained it to make it 61-60 Auburn. The Tigers hit one of two foul shots, and then Ty Jerome was bringing the ball up for Virginia.
5.4 to go. Jerome lost it for a moment, and now another foul. They had another foul to give.
That other foul might have bailed out Jerome right there in that situation.
No kidding.
Absolutely.
Because that was going to be just the desperate heat from just inside the midcourt stripe.
And they knew heady play, well-coached, well-schooled, very aware.
Timeout, Virginia.
So the foul was called, but yes, as everybody realized, there was a double dribble before the foul. The ball went off Jerome's foot. He grabbed it with both hands. He continued dribbling again, but the ref never saw that. Hell, almost nobody saw that. So a shout out to my man Gene Steratore for breaking the entire thing down. The ref was so locked in on looking for an Auburn foul because he had one to give that the double dribble was completely missed. And yes, Auburn fans, if that double dribble is called, the game is over. But it wasn't, and it was about to get worse. Roll it.
Down by two, 62-60. Jerome slaps the basketball, looking, peering, finds Guy in the left corner for three and the win. Off the rim, no good. And the Tigers claw back, but wait, was there a foul? Was there a foul in the corner? The clock is at zeros, but Auburn fouled the shooter. Bruce Pearl is at half court. He can't believe it.
In other words, it's over. Auburn wins. They're going to the national championship game. Because off the inbounds, the ball went to Guy for three, and he missed, so the game was over. But it wasn't because he was fouled in the act of shooting. And yes, again, that's a foul. And no, I'm not interested in hearing that the refs should swallow the whistle there. If it's a foul in the first minute, it's a foul in the 39th minute. That said, if they didn't call it, I wouldn't have been surprised, but they did call it, and it was a foul. Samir Doughty left his feet in one location. He landed in another. He made contact along the way, and as Steratore called it, that's an A to B jump. That's a foul. Kyle Guy goes to the line for three foul shots with 0.6 seconds left. He needed two for the tie, three for the lead, two to keep the season alive, three to put them in the national title game. Roll it.
But Guy will be at the line for three. Wow.
I'll tell you, if you're Virginia, this is the guy you want on the line. Your first team All-ACC player.
81%.
He's tied it.
Wow, this is unbelievable.
Wow.
What a finish.
Unbelievable ending.
So those first two free throws were clutch as hell. Kyle Guy is clutch as hell. My man doesn't just have ice water in his veins. He's got giant ice cubes traveling through them because there was no hesitation, no indication of pressure in that moment. And then after a timeout, here comes the third.
We need overtime tonight, or will Kyle Guy's free throw be the margin of difference? Free throw is up. It is good. Virginia by one. 0.6 seconds to go. 63-62. Dangel Purifoy will inbound for Auburn. Purifoy holds the ball. 0.6 seconds left. Purifoy throws it in. Caught. Brown. Turnaround. No. And Virginia 63. Auburn 62. The Cavaliers will play for their first national championship on the
right. Auburn tried a desperation shot. It did not go. Virginia advances with one of the most clutch final 10 seconds you're ever going to see. And then the only thing cooler than Guy at the foul line was Guy admitting in the post-game interview that he was nervous. Now, in the eyes of some, UVA went from the most boring team ever to the most exciting team ever, and they were never the most boring team ever. But that is the most brutal loss ever for Auburn. Battled their asses off to get to that game, to have the lead late in that game where they came all the way back and it fell apart in the worst way. And man, there are so many what-ifs, so many what might have beens. If Guy doesn't hit that ridiculous three with under 10 to go, Auburn wins. If Ty Jerome is called for a double dribble, Auburn wins. If they make that second foul shot with 7 seconds left, Virginia can only tie. If they don't have an extra foul to give, the ref might even see that double dribble. And if they don't foul Guy in the corner, Auburn wins. And if Kyle Guy isn't the clutchest guy on the planet, Auburn wins. Then again, if they hit more than 29% from three, Auburn wins. What I'm saying is this, a long way of saying this. Auburn got jobbed on that missed double dribble, but that's not why they lost that game. Auburn fan, that's not why you lost that game. Sure, you deserve to win. Sure, you ran a winning race. Yes, you ran your eyeballs out. You just didn't win. That happens sometimes, and it sucks. It really sucks because it took all of that for Virginia to win, and now they face Texas Tech. It's not easy to cover the whole weekend in one open, but I just did. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood does not charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Plus, there is no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data and place a trade in just four taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections, such as 100 Most Popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of this podcast a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Simply sign up at jimrome.robinhood.com. That's jimrome.robinhood.com. We are joined by Pete Thamel. Pete, great to have you back. How are you?
Jim, thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Good to have you, Pete. Thanks for doing it. Let me start, Pete, with this. Let me start with a sentence that I never thought that I'd ever say. Texas Tech is about to play for the national title in basketball. I mean, what's your reaction when you hear that?
Yeah, you know, look, if you really follow sport, you're not surprised. Chris Beard is really emerged in the past two seasons as just the supernova coach who I think is going to be one of the faces of the game for the next 20 years if he chooses to stay in college. He has all of the great qualities of his old mentor, Bob Knight, in terms of the tactical genius and the motion offense that nobody runs anymore and the man-to-man defense that made Knight famous, and the ability to make a team play hard. And look, they made the Elite Eight last year, played Villanova. Remember, Villanova blew out both Final Four teams that they played. Texas Tech played them tougher than anyone else in the NCAA tournament last year. So, you know, the last two seasons, Beard has really established himself, but he basically lost a first-round pick in Zaire Smith, resuscitated the roster with eight new guys, and brought back a better team, which is an amazing compliment. So, yes, on the surface, certainly it is stunning that Texas Tech is on the cusp of winning, and I think they are going to win tonight. But, you know, it is just this game can change so fast now. Rosters are so fluid. One and done just make the landscape so volatile that it's allowed for maybe non-traditional places like Texas Tech with a great coach and very good players in an excellent system to become consistently excellent in a short period of time.
Pete Thamel joining us. He's a college football writer, national college football and basketball reporter, actually, for Yahoo Sports. You know, Pete, then you go to Virginia, and if you go back to Saturday night, what was the atmosphere like in the final minute, and then what was it like when Kyle Guy hit that three with less than 10 seconds to go?
Well, I mean, the whole atmosphere of the final 10 seconds were just nuts. The thing I'll never forget about that 10 years from now, Jim, is that essentially everyone in the arena thought that Virginia lost. When with 1.5 seconds left, they're going from out of bounds, and obviously Guy goes up for that shot. Guy puts his jersey over his face. He thinks they've lost. The referee blows the whistle, calls the foul. Samir Doty ends up, he said after the game, the Auburn guard, he said, "I thought we won the game." Like, so it was just this weird, chaotic mix of emotions that were sort of, in reality, was communicated slowly. And so everyone in this, like, massive 72,000-seat arena was basically confused.
So, Pete, what about the now famous foul on what appeared to be the final play in regulation? What did you and everybody around you make of that call at that time?
So in real time, I didn't have a great look at it, but I thought, Jim, like, it could have been a foul. In my estimation, by the purest definitions of the rules, it was definitely a foul. If they had not called it a foul, we would not be sitting here 48 hours later discussing it. It would have been like, there's a little contact. You know, he had a tough shot to attempt to win the game, and he missed, and everybody would have moved on, and Auburn would have been playing in the game. So by going by the pure letter of the rules, which I'm not saying is the wrong thing to do, they did invite some controversy. And I think the interesting reverberation from that will be tonight. So 2 years ago, you had that awful Carolina-Gonzaga game that the referees hijacked and just turned into their own personal zebra show. And then last night, Saturday night, obviously, the referees became the story. So I think tonight, with two really hard-edged defensive teams, you're going to see a very loosely called game, which I think will be good because we need all the movement and flow we can because, you know, this thing's destined for the high 50s.
No, right. They could ugly it up. And I made the point earlier, they could ugly it up, but it's still two damn good basketball teams. Pete Thamel joining us. So, Pete, a final thought then about Auburn. If you're Bruce Pearl and you're Auburn, how do you go about processing that loss?
Well, I mean, probably the same way New Mexico State did when they lost the same way to the opening round to Auburn. I mean, it's gutting anytime you lose in this tournament to do it at that level. Bruce's reaction to the call was as raw and emotional of a coach reaction to anything. Because, I mean, he literally saw his hopes and dreams ripped away right in front of him. And his son, Stephen Pearl, at the end of the game, ran halfway across the court to yell at one of the officials. It was, you know, look, I give Auburn credit, though. In that locker room, they handled that gutting, galling, controversial loss as classy as any team I've ever seen. I'm fairly certain there were some instructions to do it like that. But Samir Doty sat there for 40 minutes and answered every question about, you know, one of the low moments of his professional life. And I give them a ton of credit for the way they handled it.
We're talking to Pete Thamel. All right, Pete, so as you look at the matchup tonight, what is the biggest question in your mind?
Well, we've had two sort of disappearing stars on Saturday night. Jarrett Culver was 1-for-10 until the final 3 minutes, and then he made a couple shots, including the dagger three in the Texas Tech-Michigan State game. Culver is obviously the lottery pick, who's the best player on Tech. DeAndre Hunter has been missing in action on offensive end for large portions of this NCAA tournament, but he came and hit all five of his shots in the second half in the semifinal for Virginia. So I think the ability for those stars to establish themselves consistently on offense is going to be key. Look, this is not going to be a sexy game, right? So it's going to be like who makes contested jumpers late in the shot clock. That's really like I talked to five coaches yesterday for a breakdown story. That's sort of what it comes down to. Virginia's a great jump shooting team. The key going into the game, if people are monitoring it, is the health of Tariq Owens, who's like this 6'10 Keon Clark clone, who's just this jumping jack in the middle and an elite shot blocker. He blocks 12% of all shots that go up when he's on the floor, which is an amazing number. He injured his ankle somewhat gruesomely on Saturday night. He was in a walking boot yesterday. Beard said he expects him to play, but there's no guarantees, and he did return, maybe on adrenaline. So his ability to be completely healthy and springy and guard the rim allows Texas Tech to do a lot of what they do in their defensive sets. So yeah. I really feel like his health is going to be one of the key factors tonight.
Pete Thamel joining us for a few more moments. You know, you touched on this, Pete, but there's also a larger question when it comes to the matchup. There are future NBA players on the floor. You mentioned a couple of them, but it's a title game that does not have a huge star like Zion Williamson. With the expectation that the NBA is going to change the age requirement to enter the draft, is this a matchup or a sign of things to come with this matchup?
Yeah, you know, I wrote about that on Saturday night off the second game, and it's interesting. Mike Krzyzewski gets really compelling comments in Washington D.C. during the round of 16, and Jim Boeheim echoed those to me on Saturday night. The NCAA is completely unprepared, like laughably unprepared, for the next iteration of what basketball is going to look like. And essentially, the NBA is coming in and giving them competition to their billion-dollar business. And the NCAA basketball doesn't have anyone specifically in charge and is not ready for this next iteration of a more competitive environment for the top high school talent. And, you know, this isn't like pay the players millions, but there needs to be evolutions to help lure top players and make college basketball, which was something you had to do essentially, now a more marketable place to go. And there are certainly a lot of positives to college basketball, including the education, the marketing, the, you know, the gyms, the college experience, all that stuff. But if you can all of a sudden go and make $100,000 and start your professional career and be in a system in one of these G League teams, that's an option that didn't exist essentially in 2005. The G League was around, but it wasn't as refined as it is now. I really think that NCAA leaders, who essentially have been mocked by Hall of Fame coaches for their lack of preparedness, need to get their act together, or, you know, quite simply, they're going to start losing out on top talent.
Pete Thamel is our guest. All right, Pete, quickly before I let you go, you've been all over the coaching carousel this offseason. Man, this UCLA search is really something to me. They're still looking for a head coach. What do you make of how that search has played out?
Well, it's been a classic case of a bunch of people get together and they think they're smarter than they are, and they completely misvalued, I guess would be the right term, how good their job is and who would take it. When you go after John Calipari and you offer him less money to go to an inferior job, it's probably not going to work. And so that got them, like, that got the laugh track started. And then it's just been, you know, hit after hit. I mean, a place like TCU isn't going to give you a discount on a buyout. They're just not going to do it. What would there be an incentive? They have an elite coach in Jamie Dixon. Why would they cut you a deal to go? You know, that, there's been a lot of arrogance there, and there's been a distinct lack of preparedness, especially if you consider they fired Steve Alford on New Year's Eve. So, I mean, I think we're in day, like, 97 of this thing. Rick Barnes is the latest name that's shown interest, and it's almost like they need to get him because, I mean, it's just been embarrassment after embarrassment for UCLA and all this.
All right, so do they get Barnes, or do you think somebody else ends up with that job?
You know, it seems like they're down the road a little bit with Barnes, but it also seems like the window's open for him to go back to Tennessee from what Evan Daniels at 247 reported this morning. Like, he was going to go talk to his AD there. So I don't know the answer to that. I think Barnes would be a nice hire and a good solution. He's an excellent basketball coach, as we've seen for three decades now. And it would be a good consolation prize. But they are definitely wandering in the wilderness if they don't get him.
He is a national college football and basketball reporter for Yahoo Sports, Pete Thamel, on a very busy day. Pete, really appreciate you, and thanks so much for doing that. Great job.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
My vacation in Mexico. I mentioned, among other things, that my 18-year-old son, Jake Rome, turned 18. He turned 18. I want to make that point. And it happened during the week in a place where 18 makes him legal. And we're talking about one of our final vacations before he goes away to college. So let's just say that the kid and the old man bumped into a couple last week. And let's also say that the kid learned a valuable lesson about not mixing. And I don't mean mixing liquor with mixers. I mean mixing straight liquor with other straight liquor. Good kid, though. Had a good time with it. And speaking into bumping into things, no sooner than I arrive in Mexico, I start thinking about a very good buddy of mine, really good friend of mine. And his name is Mauricio Oberfeld. Now, Mauricio and his partner, Matt Dugali, are legendary home builders and entrepreneurs in Los Angeles. Two amazing guys. Great, great business people. Extremely bright. And legendary home builders. They've built some of the most historic homes, literally, in the history of this town. And Mauricio is also a huge Punta Mita guy. So I'm immediately thinking, when I step down in there, I wonder if I'm going to see my man, Mo. And I turn around, and there's Mauricio. He's right there. And I didn't even know. We didn't text each other. I hadn't reached out to him. I just got there, and I thought to myself, I wonder if he's here this week, because he always is. And I turn around on day one, and there's Mauricio. And not only is he there, but his even more legendary wife, Sharon, is right there. Man, I wish I could tell you about Sharon. I mean, I can tell you about her. But she has said some of the most amazing things I've ever heard any human being ever say since I've been on this planet. I mean, she's crazy like that. Very, very smart, very funny. Two of my favorite people ever. And who are they hanging out with? One of my favorite MLBers ever in Adrian Gonzalez. And I say that not for some blatant name drop, but you're probably wondering what I was doing in a picture on Instagram with Mauricio and Akon. And I say that not to drop that name, but I say it for a reason. Now, I'm the first guy to say, we don't really know any of these athletes. I say this as a guy who's been in this game now for decades. We don't know any of these guys. Any of them. Ever. We don't. Except, if you were to have asked me, based on my interviews with Adrian Gonzalez throughout his career, what I would have said about him is, this is a guy who's a stand-up guy. Totally stand-up guy and a class act. But again, I would reiterate, we don't really know any of these guys. We don't know any of them. As always, some of the guys that you think are the best guys ever are some of the biggest jerks ever, some of the biggest bags ever. Some of the guys who you think are the biggest bags ever are actually some of the best guys ever. So my man Mauricio says we're taking our boat out. And Adrian Gonzalez and his family are coming. Do you guys want to come too? And let me just say this about Adrian. He probably... Like, I'm not going to tell you anything I shouldn't tell you about him. I don't know anything I shouldn't know about him. But he is so laid back, that he probably would prefer that I not mention this. But let me just say this. We spend a day at sea, and spending a day at sea with people is sort of like spending 4 or 5 hours on a golf course with somebody. You're going to find out what they're all about. You're going to find out what they're all about. You spend several hours with somebody at sea, and you see how they treat their family. You see how they treat your family. You see how they treat the staff on the boat. Yeah, I went there. I said that. That's how big that boat was. There was a staff on the boat. All right, that's not my deal. That's not where I live. I had a boat once, and there was no staff on the boat. It was just me and my family. But that was a pretty big boat. Anyway, Adrian Gonzalez treats everybody like gold. Gold. Not Cuervo gold, just gold. You know, his family, my family, his friends, everybody. Super classy guy. And he even gave me a brief lesson in tequila. Also not where I live, but a little bit last week. So I'm here to tell you that the point of that story is not, yo, man, great, Rome. Any other names you want to pick up that you dropped? That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you never know these guys, but if you think that that's a really good guy, you'd be right. Killed it on the field, still killing it off the field, and my man looks great. Could not be a better guy. So Mexico treated me very well. It is awesome to be back. And to answer your other questions, no. Yes, I went on a big boat with my man Mauricio and his family. Oh, and his in-laws too. That's how big that boat was. There were several families on that boat. But no, I did not go parasailing with Hanley Ramirez, smartasses. I did not do that. No, I did not go jet skiing with Juan Uribe. That was not a thing. No, I did not go whale watching with Man Ram. No, I did not go snorkeling with AJ Ellis. None of that. It was Adrian Gonzalez and his family and Mauricio Oberfeld and his family and Sharon's parents and my family. I did not go ATVing with Carl Crawford. Texting and driving is not just a dangerous problem, it is deadly. And if you drive while distracted, you're three times more likely to crash. But far too many people still do not recognize the dangers. Did you know that when you send a text or receive a text, you take your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds? At 55 miles per hour, that's like driving more than the length of a football field with your eyes closed. Between 2012 and 2017, nearly 20,000 people died in crashes involving a distracted driver. And if your own safety needed, here's another one. It's also illegal. That's why cops are writing tickets to anybody caught texting while driving, and they're doing it to save lives. So remember, if you text while driving, you will get caught. You drive, you text, you pay. We are joined by Buzz Williams. Buzz, it is great to have you back. How are you?
Rome, how you doing?
Buzz, I'm great. Head coach Buzz Williams at Texas A&M. Man, what's that like to hear for you, Buzz?
You know what I am, Rome? I'm a junior college manager, miscast as the head coach at Texas A&M. So for people to say that, you know, none of that ever resonates with me because I'm just so incredibly grateful that I'm just glad that I can still know how to mop the floor. I don't look at myself as a head coach at all.
The rest of us do, Buzz, and a real good one at that. Listen, you were an assistant at A&M under Billy Gillespie, but your roots run much deeper than that. You were born in Greenville. Your wife was a star high school player in Texas. Your son Mason was born in College Station. So how much does this feel like a homecoming for you?
Yeah, it's so unique, right? We left in 13 years ago to be the head coach at the University of New Orleans, which was right after Hurricane Katrina, and we had never been back. We had never been back until we went back on Wednesday night and was just overwhelmed with emotion and so thankful. And it's all of those things that you said. Obviously, I worked for Coach, and it was the start of a beginning of great Aggie basketball there for several years, but it's way bigger than me. And for my family of four, along with my wife and our families, to be able to experience this is very special.
Buzz Williams joining us. So before you flew to Texas, Buzz, you did speak to Billy. You called him to talk to him. What was that conversation like?
Yeah, I couldn't hardly talk. Coach was the last person that I called before I got on the plane with my family to head to Texas. And I was just so emotional, I really couldn't speak. And I just said, Coach, I wanted to let you know thank you and that I'm about to get on the plane heading to A&M. And thank you so much for all you've done. And that was literally all that I could get out just because I was crying. I was so happy and so emotional.
Hmm. Buzz Williams joining us. What was his response? What did he tell you?
You know, Coach has been the best to me from the very beginning, even when I had no idea how I could best help him as an assistant. But what he said was, I'm proud for you, and I'm proud of you. And that was really cool. Coach has had an incredible life story and been through a lot over the last 2.5, 3 years of his life. And so for all of this to turn full circle, obviously when I was there as an assistant, I had no idea what I was doing. And to be able to think that 13 years later, I would come back as the head coach, that was beyond anything that I was thinking about when I was working for Coach at A&M first time.
Buzz Williams is the head coach at Texas A&M. He joins us once again. Now, Buzz, you've rebuilt programs in the past. You and I have talked about how you've watched, learned, and encouraged guys like Frank Martin and how he rebuilt South Carolina. What about this one? I mean, is the approach going to be similar, or is every rebuild different? How do you approach this challenge?
I think they all have similarities. I think that's a really good question. I think what sometimes is misconstrued and maybe not said in with enough depth is these are people's lives, right? And change is hard, whether you're in college athletics or a Fortune 500 company, because it impacts so many lives, not just me, but my wife and children. But that's just a portion of it. It's my staff. It's those players that are there. It's those coaches and staff and families that were at A&M. And the thing that I've really tried to concentrate on, this is my fifth day at A&M, is to make sure that I have grace and to make sure that I have humility in how I handle each person. It's not just the Texas A&M people. It's also Virginia Tech, right? There were families impacted when I left. There were players and the families that they represent that I left, their coaches. And so trying to have grace in all of that, I think, is the right exit from Blacksburg, but I also think that it's the right entrance to College Station. So I'm trying to be better this rep that I have than I have in the previous reps, just because as I've gotten older, hopefully I've gotten a little bit more mature on how to handle each of these situations with more grace.
We're talking to Buzz Williams. That's a great word, grace. You know, to that point, you've also endowed a pair of scholarships at Virginia Tech that will continue. Yep. So your legacy is going to endure there. And you're somebody, as you point out, that with each rep, you want to be better, you want to improve. So as you look back, Buzz, how are you different as a coach now than before you went to Blacksburg?
There's no way, Rom, that I can answer that in the right way. You know, the lessons that I've learned as a leader in Blacksburg are unquantifiable. Dr. Sands, Whip Babcock have fully supported everything we did during our 5 years here. And, you know, we went from 2-16. They had finished in last place prior to our arrival for a couple of years, and then we did the same. And then fast forward through 5 years to finish in the Sweet 16. That's so much bigger than an out-of-bounds play or so much bigger than secondary break. There's so many lessons on how to transform something. You know, it wasn't a transaction, it was a transformation. And anytime there's a transformation, that can only happen with a lot of people pulling in the same direction. And so I'm so thankful for my time in Blacksburg because of what I learned, not only as a coach, that would probably be the smallest thing, but it's what I learned as a father, it's what I learned as a husband, it's what I learned as a leader. And I hope that I can package those things, if that's the right word, and make sure that as we get started here in College Station, that we're even better over the next 5 years as we get going at A&M in comparison to what we did at Tech.
Buzz Williams is the head coach at Texas A&M. We have him for a few more moments. So, Buzz, you're entering an SEC that was already loaded. It's getting even stronger. As an example, my next guest on the show is Jerry Stackhouse, who's taking over at Vanderbilt. You're coming from a brutal conference in the ACC, but how tough is the SEC going to be?
You know, every coach thinks that the league they coach in is the best. I remember when I was in the Sun Belt, I thought it was the best conference in the world, and nothing has changed. You know, when I was at Marquette in the what was the old Big East,
I felt the same. And I think that's what's transpiring in the SEC. I think the initiatives that Commissioner Sankey has been a part of, specific to the administrative people across the league, the commitment to basketball has changed significantly over the last 5 years. I think that you're seeing that. Obviously, Coach Pearl and Auburn were playing 2 days ago. Last year, Coach Martin and the Gamecocks were playing. So you saw that commitment level continue to change the trajectory of the league in a very positive way. And I felt the same way at Virginia Tech. You know, they would finally give us our schedule in mid-September, and I would look at it and would never look at it again. I would glance at it one time and never look at it and ask my assistant just to put the dates on my calendar, because you just get – you look at that and you're like, I don't know if we're going to ever win a game. And I think that's what's happening a little bit across the board in the SEC with Coach Stackhouse, with Coach Musk going to Arkansas and the job he did at Nevada. So, for sure, that's what's taking place in the SEC.
That's a coaches' league. There are some amazing coaches in that league. Now, Buzz, before Very I let good. You go, you know, you and I have talked about your journey in the past. I bring it up once again because it is incredible. It is inspiring. And if I had told you back in the day, Buzz, when you were sweeping floors and washing socks for Lewis Orr, that you would one day be the head coach at Texas A&M, what would you have said back then?
No, I would have been honored just to know that somebody gave me a number to call so that I could hear your voice. This is beyond anything I ever thought of. You know, Coach Orr is 82 and was at the press conference room on Thursday in College Station. 18 NCAA tournament games that I've been able to be a part of as the head coach, and two people in my world have been at all 18, my wife and coach. What I'm trying to do, and I mean this very respectfully, I'm just trying to delay my inevitable return to hauling hay. And so as long as I can get my picture in the next media guide, it means I got one more year, hopefully, that I can have a positive impact on people's lives around me. But I would have never, ever, 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 I wasn't smart enough, and I'm still not smart enough to reach outside my paradigm and think that something like this would ever become reality.
Buzz Williams, he was an assistant at Texas A&M from 04 to 06, had 5 great years at Virginia Tech with 100 wins, led Virginia Tech to a school record 26 wins this season, not just a Sweet 16 run, came that close to knocking off Duke, and the former student manager at Navarro College back home at A&M. Buzz, I appreciate you so much. Great to have you on. Congrats on that. Now we'll look forward to our next conversation, Buzz.
I can't wait to be on. Thank you so much for allowing me to be a part today, Roman.
Hey, remember that time that Yasiel Puig tried to fight the entire city of Pittsburgh? Of course you do, because it just happened. We go now to yesterday's game between the Reds and the Pirates. The Pirates were going with their throwbacks, and that was just the start of the old school action. Because in the top of the second inning, Reds outfielder Derek Dietrich did this.
Now the batter, Derek Dietrich, is filling in for Votto. And how about this? Way back into right center field, and Dietrich is homered for the second time. The man sitting in for Votto after Farmer sitting in for Suarez yesterday hit a home run. How about that? You better get in the drink, Chris. Looks like something you might hit off the tee. Wow.
So let me ask you this. Did you like that home run? You like that? You like that? Derek Dietrich did. And Dietrich loved that home run. He admired the hell out of that home run. If he had stared at that any longer, he would have needed to buy a ticket. Pirates pitcher Chris Archer probably hated that home run as much as Dietrich loved it. Archer probably hated that home run and hated how Dietrich stared at it afterwards. Because in the top of the fourth, when Dietrich came to bat once again, Archer let him know all about it, and he let him know all about it with a pitch behind Dietrich. You see, that's a code enforcement warning. There are some guys that you can style a home run off of, and Chris Archer is not one of those guys, at least not if you're Derek Dietrich, and you do it the way Dietrich did. So Archer did what he did, and then everyone did everything. And by everyone doing everything, what I really mean is Yasiel Puig tried to fight everybody.
Well, David Bell is hot. Boy, is he hot. He is really hot.
And then Archer kind of made a couple of steps towards Dietrich. And that's when the benches began to empty.
That'd be a bad day for Archer running into Dietrich. That'd be a very bad day. And now Puig was held back for a while there, and he escapes the hold of Cabrera and Votto, and he's trying to find Archer.
This is not going to end well for anybody out there. Puig, by coming back into the pile like that, is not doing himself any good when it comes to playing time, because the league is going to take a hard look at him.
I disagree with that take that this is not going to end well for anybody out there, because it ended pretty well for me. You see, that started off like a normal, classic baseball fight, which is to say it was not a fight at all. It's a bunch of guys yelling at each other, some guys jogging in reluctantly from the bullpen because they know that if they don't, their own guys in their own clubhouse will want to fight them. And then you got people being, quote, held back from a fight that wasn't really a fight that nobody wanted any part of anyway. At least that's how that whole thing went until Yasiel Puig showed up. Because Yasiel Puig didn't just want part of that fight. Yasiel wanted all of that fight for himself. And did I say that at the very start that Yasiel Puig tried to fight the entire city of Pittsburgh? Let me reset that. That's probably not fair. My man was taking on all of Western Pennsylvania. Erie! Altoona! Moon Township! Reaction! Step to me or get your ass kicked! Yasiel Puig versus the Pirates was better than anything and everything that took place at WrestleMania. I mean, I'm not sure at this point what's more ridiculous. The code in baseball or Yasiel Puig trying to fight an entire baseball team. Like, if you were wearing yellow and black yesterday, there was a very good chance that Yasiel Puig swung on you. And if you want to defend the code, Puig wants some of you as well. Puig said, quote, "When people watch the baseball go far away or do bat flips like I do before, in the next at bat, try to strike out the guy. Don't try to hit the guy because we can't defend you back because we can't hit you with a bat or nothing," end quote. Did you ever think you'd see the day where Yasiel Puig would be the voice of reason? Like, we can't, quote, defend you back or hit you with a bat. I mean, he's got a point, right? Guys styling or not styling home runs is something that does bring some juice to the game. Guys hitting a home run and immediately sprinting to first base with their head down is boring. Guys styling it a little bit brings some juice. It brings some energy, something baseball needs. And Dietrich practically setting up a telescope on home plate to watch that did bring some much-needed energy to the game. A game that involved the Reds losing their eighth straight. Why else would you watch them if not for something like that? Let me just say this about the code. And I've said this before, and now more than ever. Man, the code is bizarre. Baseball's code is bizarre. It's antiquated. And it generates takes like this from Pirates reliever Felipe Vázquez. That Dietrich, quote, "shouldn't have done that. If you do something like that, you're going to pay for it. We're trying to play the game like we have to. Respect the game. He shouldn't do it. Joey can do it because he's been here a long time. But for a guy like that, he's not supposed to do something like that. I think it was a little too much," end quote. Vázquez was one of the five guys who got ejected from that game and said he was tossed because he entered the field without a jersey. And for a guy who wasn't wearing a jersey, I've got to say he was pretty passionate about Dietrich paying a price. You know, his take being, you were designated for assignment in the offseason, so you're the last guy who should be styling anything. Leave that to the guys who actually matter. And you got to love the code. You have to love how the code allows for certain ways to style certain homers if you're a certain kind of guy. Like, if you're good, you can do it, but don't do it too much. But you, if you're you and you were designated for assignment and you suck, you can't do it ever. Don't even think about doing it if you're that guy. Then you're going to get one in your ear. Or, if you were designated for assignment, don't do it unless you want to leave in a body bag. I mean, the code is so awesome. The code truly is amazing at this point. Except that's not how Archer sees it. Right? The guy who made the pitch. Archer said, quote, I was trying to go in. I airmailed a couple of balls today, a couple that I was trying to elevate, a couple that I yanked when righties were up there, another one that I just yanked. He added, quote, I missed my spot. That's a pro right there. That's a pro. I love Archer. That's my guy. That's one of my favorite guys. That is my guy. He is one of the smartest guys in the game. He knows what he's doing there, both with the pitch and the explanation. I love Chris Archer. That said, I'm going to go ahead and guess that he did, in fact, hit his spot. He says he didn't. I'm going to guess that he did. And his spot was right behind Dietrich. And yeah, it's pretty archaic. Not to mention dangerous. The guys will throw a rock at 90-plus just to warn somebody for how they looked at a home run. Pretty archaic. Pretty barbaric. Pretty dangerous, right? I mean, like, nobody would ever allow a guy to take a bat to the mound with them. But it's okay to throw a baseball 95 at a guy? Then again, if the code gives us moments like that, I'm not really sure how to feel about it. Because while it's archaic, Yasiel Puig wanting to fight everybody in Pittsburgh was probably the best action from the Reds in years. I mean, I have not been that into a Reds game since Chris Sabo was playing the hot corner. And man, that was the best time ever. Hey, Yas, don't change. Don't change. Don't ever change. And the best part is, I know you won't, because I've seen your act. And that was not the first time, and thankfully, I know it won't be the last. And again, Cincinnati, you're welcome. Not to go Matt in L.A. on you, but you're welcome. You're welcome, Natty. How fun was that? Literally the best thing I've seen from the Reds since Chris Sabo was Chris Sabo back on the hot corner. That was wild. Back when Barry Larkin was an MVP. Back when the nasty boys were doing nasty things. Shout out to my man, Eric Davis. Remember Eric Davis way back in the day? I'll be way, 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 way back in the day. Eric Davis was one of the first guys to lay out that concept of you really are who you roll with. And when you're from the neighborhood, you don't want to forget where you're from, but you got to be careful when you go back to the neighborhood because you don't know what the guys in the neighborhood have been doing and if they bring any of that to you. I remember the first time Eric Davis said that on this show, and it was so long ago, but it was so profound. It was truly awesome. What year was this? I'm trying to remember. I don't know if we were talking about Allen Iverson and his crew. Whatever it was, Eric, and because there was this whole notion, and there still is a notion, that you cannot forget where you're from. Because those that you came up with would argue, we are entitled to some of this. We have equity in this. You are who you are because of us. And Eric Davis on this show a long, long time ago said, not necessarily. Because I don't know what you've been up to. And if you bring that around me when I've been taking care of my business, that's not good.
Your homeboys, quote unquote, have to understand and respect what you do, first and foremost, in order for the mix to work. They have to know and respect Allen to a point to where they say, we can't bring what we do around Allen. You know, and if they don't understand that, then they're not my real friend anyway. And I still drive down to my old neighborhood, and I still see a lot of the old guys. But when I see them in passing. Hey, I got a horn. How you doing? Yeah, I'll holler at you later. That's the bottom line. I'm not saying that I'm better than you, but I don't have time to sit down in this corner and talk to you. No, I don't know what you was doing last year. I've been gone for a year. I don't know if somebody after you or what. I'm taking care of business.
I've been out taking care of business.
Right. I'm not going to get caught up on this corner with you. I don't know what you did. And they understand that because I told them that those was the ground rules. Allen has to set ground rules. And if they don't abide by his ground rules, then they got to go.
Well, that is something else. That was Eric Davis, former Red, former Dodger. Eric Davis in, I want to say, 2001. 2001. That's only two decades ago. That's Eric Davis talking about Allen Iverson and Iverson and his crew and what they bring around him. Amazing. I get a kick out of that sometimes. Old school stuff. We are joined by the head coach at Vanderbilt. It is Jerry Stackhouse. Stack, it is so good to have you back. How are you, Jerry?
I'm great, Ron, man. How you doing?
Stack, I'm so good. You know, I had to cut your resume short because if I kept reading it, we would not have time for the actual interview. But let me start right here. How does it feel to add head coach to that resume?
Man, it feels awesome, man. I'm so excited to be here, to be able to have a chance to kind of put an imprint on this team with these guys. You know, this university. I mean, such a great university, man. So I'm excited to get going for sure.
Jerry Stackhouse, my guest. You know, Stack, you and I haven't talked in the last couple of years, but I've been watching you from afar, and it seems to me you had a plan, and you were working that plan, and the plan had you on track for an NBA head coaching job, but then Vanderbilt approaches you about this opportunity. What was it about this opportunity that excited you so much?
Well, obviously, I mean, those 2 years that you talked about when I was in the G League, you know, formerly the D League, I had an opportunity to see, you know, Malcolm Turner, you know, work, you know, the things, how he grew that league. And when he came to me and approached me with the opportunity of coming in and heading this job, or like you said, I really wasn't focused on college. I think my trajectory, you know, in the NBA was on course. But, I mean, I just thought, you know, he talked about doing something special here. This is a special place. It's a really, you know, basketball is special to this community, to this fan base, to the alumni. And being able to get it back on track was something that was somewhat of a challenge, because we have to do it with, you know, with kids that we can't just walk into any top 100 gym and say, okay, we like that kid. You know, because of the academics here, it's a little bit more challenging, a little bit tougher here. And I just, you know, that challenge itself was something that I welcomed and wanted to help him have success.
Jerry Stackhouse is the new head coach of Vanderbilt. You know, Stack, I'm going to talk to you more about that in a minute, but I want to talk about how you got here. I mean, for instance, you had an amazing college and professional career. You could have done a number of things when you retired, but you went into coaching, and it wasn't like some luxury coaching gig either. You were an assistant with Toronto, and you coached the Raptors affiliate in what is now the G League, as you point out. Man, this is not a glamorous life. You're coaching in small gyms. You're in Delaware, Maine, Fort Wayne. What was the experience like for you?
Man, it was cool, man, because, I mean, obviously basketball takes you a lot of places, and I didn't think that I would ever be in Portland, Maine, but it was good, man. I had an opportunity to see some places and have a chance to work and develop with kids, and it helped me, man. I had 15 new guys that I had to try to figure out a way to win with right away, and then the next year I had another 15 guys that I had to try to figure out a way to win with. It's similar to this situation, so I think it definitely helped prepare me for that. Yeah, the long bus rides, the commercial flights, getting up 5 a.m. in the morning. You know, I just think those are things that I needed to do to almost kind of catapult myself and ahead of a few people, because I was so focused. I mean, I love to teach. I love the game of basketball. I love to see guys get better. You know, I started my own AAU program, and that's where I really kind of, you know, had found that passion to see guys get better, see kids get better. And now I had the ability to work with pros and do that, and now I'm coming back to that kind of that intermediate stage of high school kids and pros and able to have an impact there as well. So that's what I love to do. I mean, I'm a basketball lifer and love to be able to give back the things I learned from the great coaches and teachers that I've been fortunate to play for.
Jerry Stackhouse joins us. He's the new head coach of Vanderbilt. And when you talk about the great coaches and the great teachers, of course, Stack, you start with Dean Smith. You played for Dean Smith in North Carolina, and I know the impact that he had on you. How much of Dean is in you as a coach right now?
I mean, a ton of it. I mean, I would say, you know, if I had to put a percentage on it, I would say 85%. You know, then probably I've taken probably 15% from a lot of other great coaches that I played for, you know, Rick Carlisle, Don Nelson, you know, Doug Collins, Avery Johnson, guys I played for at the professional level, who I've taken a little bit of things from all of them, from an offensive standpoint and from a defensive standpoint as well. I think that's where we really, you know, but as a scorer, you know, I figured out things that I didn't like to see as an offensive player, and try to build a defensive scheme and defensive identity around those things. And for me, I've been able to have some success with that.
Stack, take me back. When you were one of the truly elite high school players in the country and every program was coming for you, what was it like when Dean came to recruit you, and how did your mother respond to it?
Oh, man, it was fun. I think I had him kind of staggered in that day, and Steve Fisher from Michigan was coming in around 10. And like, I go back, my mom never really kind of pushed me toward any basketball. She just kind of let the recruiting process, you know, take care of itself. But she had, you know, when Steve Fisher came in, she had some donuts and she had some coffee around 10. And then I think Coach Smith was scheduled to come in around 1. at about noon, all of a sudden I see fried chicken going, pork chops, cabbage, the yams, and everything. I'm like, man. So, you know, that was just that little subtle nudge that, hey, you know, I didn't even think she knew who Dean Smith was, but, man, she obviously she did because she had a spread for him, not so much for Coach Fisher.
That is incredible. That is an amazing story. Jerry Stackhouse joining us. So that little Southern nudge. You know, you mentioned AAU ball. You're really familiar with AAU ball because you've created AAU teams. So what about recruiting now? How do you go about recruiting, and what is your message to recruits about Vanderbilt and the opportunity that you have there?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, with NCAA rules, I'm going to have separation from the AAU. My own AAU program, but those relationships, man, those relationships I had with coaches and directors of different programs across the country, they're going to be, you know, beneficial to our program because I, you know, as kids come up, that meets the academic profile as well as the athletic profile that we're looking for. You know, it's great to have the talent agents and, you know, and talent scouts and all that they bring to us to kind of help find those names. But it's still, you know, 6 degrees of separation from really getting to those directors and the people that really matter to have an impact with his kids. Unfortunately, those relationships helped me do that. So there's already been a number of people contacting me about players and different things like that. So I don't anticipate the recruiting being, you know, too much of an issue. But you know, there's always challenges with anything, just being in something new. And you know, so obviously I'm going to have a staff around me that really understands the college game, obviously a little better than I do since it's my first job. So I'm taking all those things into account, you know, when it starts to, you know, deal with my staffing as well.
That's smart. Jerry Stackhouse joining us for a few more moments. You know, Stack, Vanderbilt, of course, combines the chance for tremendous academic and athletic success. You left North Carolina early to enter the draft, but then you went back and you wrapped up your degree. You finished it off. Again, it's not something that you had to do because you had a really, really good NBA career. Why was that important to you? Why did you go back and finish that up?
Well, I mean, it was something that I promised to my mom that I would do. My mom was always big on academics, you know. I mean, and I took pride as a young guy, you know, making honor roll, making the principal's list. You know, aside from my athletic prowess, I took pride in those things. I was actually salutatorian of my senior class. So, I mean, I think those are things that people don't know, and where my focus was as far as the academic side. I've taken courses at Harvard just to try to expand who I am as a person. Obviously, I spent a lot of time on the basketball court from college to pros, and just wanted to be able. I knew I was transitioning out of the league, and I just wanted to be able to look at a spreadsheet and understand what I was looking at, different things like that. So that was really important to me, and those are the things that I'm going to continue to try to emphasize with our guys. I mean, we're going to have an opportunity to not only have some special talent here as far as athletics, but the academic side of things here are going. We're going to have people that are really going to be a part of shaping the world, you know, in the near future. So I'm excited about being able to touch those type of kids, the type of the professors that we hear, the type of game. It's like 35,000 applicants for like 1,600 spots, you know, incoming freshmen. So the competition is unbelievable, and just being able to be around those type of people, we're all going to be able to benefit from that.
Jerry Stackhouse joins us. And Stack, one last thought. Vanderbilt, as you know, is coming off a tough year. It included them going winless in the SEC, a 20-game losing streak. You know what you're signing up for. What is the identity that you're looking to build within the program? How is a Jerry Stackhouse team going to look?
We're going to be a defensive team. I mean, I think that's the, you know, obviously we want to, you play offense according to your personnel. And obviously I've inherited a situation. I've inherited the personnel here. I hadn't had a chance to kind of put my imprint on the recruiting and the type of players that I would like to have in there. But I'm confident because I've done it in the G League of being handed a team and having to try to do something with it. And there's some talented people. You have some McDonald's All-Americans that are here. So they've had some success recruiting over the past, and it just hadn't translated on the court. So hopefully, you know, like I said, we're going to be the identity of us as a work team, a team that comes in and grind and make it tough on offensive teams. But at the same time, we want to play with pace, and we want to play with great spacing and be able to utilize the personnel that we have, kind of build, not saying that we have a certain offensive philosophy, but
build it around our personnel that the best suits them and make the most of their strengths.
He was named head coach on April 5th, introduced as Commodores head coach earlier today, and back in the jungle. Stack, as I mentioned, it's been a few years. It is great to see you doing so well, and so good to have you back on the show, Jerry. Really nice talking to you, Stack. Congrats.
Likewise, man. I appreciate you, Rome. Thank you.
Appreciate you, Stack. Always have. Always will. Jerry Stackhouse.
Good night now!